This is Lives, and I'm your host, Stuart Chittenden. My guest today is musician and writer, Anna Schulte. Anna Schulte is a musician and writer from Omaha, Nebraska. She released her debut EP, Dream Car, in 2022, and her poetry has been published in Paper Darts and 433. Schulte has a BA in English Writing and French from Loyola University in New Orleans, and currently is pursuing a master's degree in speech-language pathology. Her work is centered in her search for belonging and meaning in a world where suffering exists side by side with such ordinary miracles as lemon trees, poppy seeds, and the color red. She has spent the last decade living in New Orleans, France, and Omaha. As well as joining me in conversation today, Schulte will perform a few of her songs for us live in the studio. Anna Schulte, welcome to Lives.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what were you like as a child?
Dramatic, very needy, always wanted to be in the spotlight, and constantly told I was too sensitive, not necessarily by like my family, but just in general. And I loved clothes. Not a big family. There were three of us, my sister and my brother, both older than me, and then my mom and dad.
I'm sure there's an interrelationship between music and writing, and we'll explore that in our conversation. But let's start with music. How did music first show up in your life?
Well, it was always in the background. From a young age, I was taking piano lessons, and I refused to learn theory, which I really regret now. But I enjoyed it, you know, and I would come up with songs on my own, and I would always be singing. And I guess it didn't really take a forefront until I was in high school. It's interesting because so many of my earliest memories of loving music are also, they're kind of painful because they're like half of those memories is loving it and then also sort of hiding my own voice. I remember in music class, I always wanted to sing something or like be in a play, but my voice wasn't good enough. and I sang a lot lower than the other girls. And I didn't know enough about music to know that that was called something. What is it? I think I'm an alto. I'm not really sure. But I wasn't what like the typical girl was in like the fourth grade or something. So I guess a lot of those memories are just, you know, singing to myself around the house, singing really loud with my door closed and other music on so that no one could hear me.
Anna, would you please play a song for us?
This song is called Overcome Skaters, and it's one I just finished this summer, and it's about the experience of meeting someone and getting to know someone and feeling like they accompanied you in all of these moments from your past. As I was writing it, like just very vivid memories were surfacing, and you'll hear those in the song.
Oh, the kind of love that makes you shy to be yourself because yourself is all you got. The flash inside a room and suddenly you see you standing in a room. All the obvious is miraculous. Under the bed, you draw the same picture over and over. Such specificity, it's almost divine. I'll trace your childhood into mine. Isn't that what a memory is for? I've met you before. Childhood home, conversing with spirits underneath the back porch, sitting on the sand when Patrick said.
When did band life start for you? So I know that over a decade or more ago, you were in a band called Pretty Healthy. And I don't know if that was your first band or if that was one in a line of bands that you were in, or if you've juxtaposed that with being a solo performer too. So what was this journey into being a musician?
Yeah, I have to laugh when you say Pretty Healthy because it was just so much fun. Every part of it was just joyful and silly. We would throw shows together the day before and like post on Facebook and be like, we're going to play here in this person's basement between this time and this time, maybe. And I'd been writing songs for years. But again, I don't know why, but I was always just so scared to share them. I didn't grow up in like a musical family. I didn't know anyone who played in bands, or anyone very artistic really growing up. And even in high school, I kind of kept to myself. And so it felt, not possible. And for whatever reason, I just remember sending a text to my friend Kyle, who was a drummer, and just being like, hey, want to get together and I can show you some songs. And my friend, Joe at the time, now June, was there. And we just sat in Kyle's parents' basement and had so much fun. That was maybe, I was 19. And that probably lasted from when I was 19 to 21 or 22. And that's the only band I've played in. I definitely am very comfortable in the space of songwriting and solo performing, but it feels very vulnerable for me to create alongside other people. I would like to do more of it, though, because that was one of the most joyful, rewarding, hilarious experiences of my life.
Was there any time during that experience where you thought you could pursue that more into your long-term future? Just generally being a musician, whether in a band or otherwise?
It's what I've always wanted, but I think was afraid to admit to myself. So I'm finally at a place of knowing myself and not hiding from myself that this is what I want to do with my life. And I believe it's what I was called to do. It feels more natural than anything else. And definitely there were glimpses of it during that time when I was playing with Pretty Healthy, especially because people really responded to the music and had a great time, but it was all kind of chaotic. And I didn't live here. You know, we were only together on breaks. It was based in Omaha, but I lived in New Orleans. June lived in New Orleans. Everyone else in the band, I think, lived in Lincoln or Omaha. So it was just kind of, I didn't really foresee longevity with Pretty Healthy. But at the time, I definitely knew that this was something I wanted to do.
Clearly, not that writing is a direct competitor with being a musician, because there's so much in those creative arts that work together. But you also are a writer. And I'm wanting to ask the same question as I did about music, which is, when did writing first show up in your life as something that stirred you?
Yeah, writing was my first love. It was the first place I felt safe within myself and where I felt that I had a self. It was like this awakening when I started writing. My sister is a writer as well. She's 6 years older than me. She introduced me to poetry when I was like in second grade, I think. She was reading me John Donne and Tennyson and Poe, and poetry that I've definitely, you know, looking back, I'm like, it's wild that like I was a child and didn't necessarily understand what was being said in these poems, but they just moved me so much. And I remember I had this teddy bear notebook in the second grade, and that was my poetry notebook. And I still have it, actually. And my sister was just so encouraging. Her name's Emily. And I would go into Emily's room and we'd sit on her bed and we'd share the poetry that we'd written with each other. And she had a poetry notebook too, which is probably like how I got the idea. Yeah, writing definitely was, honestly, like music kind of took me by surprise when I fell in love with music when I was 15, because I was like, I'm going to be a writer. And I wrote a book in the fifth grade. I was like, I remember emailing publishers and being like, I have this book, will you read it? And one of them from like a big publishing house, like, because I didn't even know what like an indie press was so kind and emailed me back and was like, when you're 18, I'd love to read your work. I think I was 11, and it was just so sweet that she responded. So writing was definitely my earliest love.
Well, you did pursue that. You took that love to college. Mm-hmm. And so you went to Loyola and you studied English writing and French. Mm-hmm. Interesting combination. What was motivating these choices?
Well, writing, again, I just always knew it was what I wanted to do, and I found that I was good at it, and it came easier than anything else. And I loved it. I loved studying writing. I miss being in an English department all the time and having writers' workshops. And French was just, I've just always loved French. I think it's beautiful. It's such a musical language. I love who I am when I'm speaking French, because I find that I'm a little different. Different parts of myself come out when I'm forced to speak with just in a different language, and when my vocabulary is more limited. And the double major just ended up happening because I studied abroad in France and had enough credits. For my capstone, I had to do two. And for my French capstone, I wrote poems in French, and my teacher was I had one teacher who was like a playwright, and he was very encouraging and wonderful. And my other teacher was like, what is going on? I don't know what any of these mean. But yeah, they definitely, they've always kind of gone hand in hand for me.
It was in the spring of 2015 that you studied for 6 months in Nantes in France. You said that it was there where you experienced firsthand the power of language to be either a barrier or a bridge between individuals attempting to participate in a new culture. And you've alluded to that a little bit when you were sharing how you were writing poems in French, but also how you could tap into a different part of yourself, express yourself, surface a different identity when you were using a different language. So what was it about that experience then in France that brought you some of this realization about language?
It shaped every single moment of my day. I've always loved language, but I've always also taken it for granted because I'm someone who relies so much on it. I'm used to being able to say, if not say, at least to write exactly how I feel and exactly what I want to say. And when I was there, I was so uncomfortable. I had to get used to only saying 50% or 80% of what I really meant. Honestly, it allowed so much room for grace in my interactions. One of my best friends there was from China, and our only shared language was French. And I remember I was Catholic at the time, and I remember trying to explain transubstantiation to her in French at lunch. And she grew up with no religion, and it was just like, it was a hilarious and humbling experience almost every day there. And it really, it made me start thinking of, yeah, like language as a, as like little threads going out between people, you know? And I'd already been thinking about this because I taught at the, or I tutored at the Writing Center, all through undergrad. And that was a really moving experience too, because people would come in and they would have big ideas, beautiful ideas, but it wouldn't translate onto the page. And so like I would read their work or, you know, just read the first paragraph and I'd be like, what are you trying to say here? And then they would be able to say it perfectly. And so I was like, what is that gap between we know what we want to say in our heads and we can't put it down on the page? So I'd already been thinking about that between like verbal language and writing. And then, it just really was brought home to me in France because it was the difference between like getting what I wanted at the grocery store or not, or making a friend or not making a friend. It was so essential.
You went back. So you had those two experiences where you studied there. But also then you went back teaching English as a second language. Why did you go back, and how did your experience, perhaps, as it were, being French, speaking French, living as French people do, how did that shift at all?
I realize now, I mean, I've always known this, but I seem to routinely forget that I'm a very all-in person. And so I think most people would be like, I want to visit France. But for me, it wasn't enough. I was like, I need to live there. And it's that way in like every aspect of my life. If I'm into something, I want to do it 200% instantly. And but it had always just been a dream that I would return to when things were hard. There were like, I'd say a year or so before I left for France was such a time of like standstill. I was living in New Orleans and I saw my life possibly fanning out in all these different directions. And I had been at this moment before when I, because I lived in Omaha between 2017 and 2018, just kind of came back to regroup. And I, at that time, I knew I wanted to move again. And I was thinking, is it France or New Orleans? And I ended up dating someone in New Orleans and I visited France and didn't have a great trip. And so I was just like, I guess it's New Orleans. And then I found myself at that place again where I was once again like met with this question, like, will I move there? This is what I've always wanted to do. And I don't even know why, you know, but it felt like I had to do it. I was just so stuck in New Orleans and I didn't know a way forward. And I didn't even know why I was stuck. You know, I was dating someone I loved. I had a job that I liked enough. I'm so glad I did. Honestly, I feel like because I moved to France, I am where I am now with my music and with stepping in to myself as an artist, and with really loving myself in a deeper way than I knew how to before. Living there, if anyone is thinking about it, just be ready. It's going to be hard. And it gets easier, you know, it gets easier over time. But like, it was so, I was just like overwhelmed with the administrative difficulties, with issues with my visa, with finding an apartment, but I had to have a guarantor, if that's even how you say that word. I was getting hit with all these random $100 charges from my internet company, and I'd be arguing with them in French on the phone, and I had to fill out my taxes in French. And it was just like, I had no one to help me. And I wasn't fluent, you know, I was stepping towards fluency. I was like the closest I've ever been to fluency when I left. I'd been there for 8 months. Yeah, I didn't even look up the first 6 months because I was like, I sold a lot of my stuff when I left New Orleans. I was just like, this is it, I'm moving. And thank God I didn't sell everything. Thank you, Mom and Dad, for keeping some of my stuff in your house. It's hard to move anywhere. But it was at month 8, and I had some really like difficult things happen when I first got there that I was still kind of struggling with. And I also was running out of money. And so, sorry, this is such a long answer to your question, but it's just funny how things sort of unfold. I was just sitting in my apartment and I was like, my life is so beautiful here. Like, I was living in the medieval quarter of Toulouse in this gorgeous apartment that was somehow 700 euros a month. And my best friend was from Wisconsin and lived down the block from me. You know, I could go to the market every day for fresh food. And it was like, kind of like when I was in New Orleans, I was like, there's so much beauty in my life. I came here and I was right. Like, I love France. I thrive in this culture. I make sense to myself in this culture, but I'm not happy. And I also had to push against, and I remember talking about this with another American there, like, we put this expectation on ourselves when we leave, like, what does it mean to succeed? Like, does it mean we never go home? Like, we're expats forever? And it was just like sort of unwinding that like rope that I had around myself about what success meant for me there, and just bringing it down to the lowest level and being like, what do I want? And am I getting what I need? I found like really simple answers to those questions. I was like, I do want to be in France, but I don't want to live here. I want to come back like 3 months every year because you can do a holiday visa for 90 days.
I wanted to talk about something else that you wrote, and it's in a blog post titled Selfies, Synthesizers, Japanese Beatles.
Oh my God.
And you said, and this is old, but you said, when I used to feel lonely, which was and is often, I would sit down and journal until I fell asleep every night. I would explore deeply that part of me that felt neither seen nor heard, that did not understand herself and still does not. I would read poetry. I would try to pray. Given what you shared earlier, that you were not necessarily maybe great at expressing verbally what you were thinking, but when you were writing, you were really clear and articulate about how you showed up to yourself. And given your descriptions of France and living in this perfect world, but perhaps not being entirely happy for various reasons, I'm curious if this sense of loneliness or existential wonder about why you're living in your life is still a theme for you.
Always. It never goes away. I was talking to a friend recently. I don't even remember the context, but I was basically like, tell me what you're thinking. And she was like, Anna, sometimes I'm thinking nothing. And I was floored. Like every down moment, I feel like I go back to that like existential doom place. And really, I am trying to structure my life in a way where I can live in harmony with it and be okay with it. Because for sure, when I wrote that blog post, I still thought that there would be a moment where I wouldn't have that. And I, you know, I believe now that it will always come back. And that's okay. It's definitely a theme. And I've realized too that I'm happier when I create the space for it that it demands by just like taking a lot of time alone.
So your 2022 EP Dream Car. So there's five tracks. It's beautifully melodic. The lyrics are hauntingly crafted. And off air, you shared with me just the difficulty sometimes of wrangling adjectives and getting them in the right place to do what you want them to do. And however, words like moody, atmospheric, poetic, self-searching, poignant, ethereal, they all came to mind for me as I listened to the EP. But also, though, it's pretty clear that there are moments of whimsy and wit and astute observation about the world and also yourself. So I do want to talk a little bit about that EP and the music. What was the genesis of the EP? Where did the inspiration come for it musically and lyrically?
Lyrically, those were just songs that I'd written over the course of maybe 5 or 10 years. And I do think that, like, I'm a very, for better or worse, existential person, and also a very playful, childlike person. And I think play is just an essential part of being alive and being joyful and finding a way through. And so I'm glad that that came across. In terms of the music, so much of that was Nate Van Fleet. He was the one who recorded and produced the EP, and just like a fabulous multi-instrumentalist, jazz drummer, engineer. I had tried to record those songs, not necessarily those songs, but any of my songs many times with different people. And one of two things would happen. They would either try to turn them into pop songs, or, you know, they didn't know what to do with it. And so nothing would really happen. Like, they would just record me, but nothing else. And so I have all of these recordings of those songs in my laptop. I remember when I reached out to Nate, I had very low expectations because I didn't really know him, but I was just basing them on my past experiences. But we had recorded together once before with Pretty Healthy. And I remembered him being so kind and so encouraging. I just struggle with self-confidence in general. And at the time, really struggled with it, recording with Pretty Healthy. And he was so present and wonderful and really knew what he was doing. And so, he was like, I have a studio in the basement of this church. Let's book a couple of days when you're in town. And when I got there, he asked me to just play some of the songs that I was thinking about recording. It just felt different immediately. The main cue for me was that he didn't start playing immediately when I did. He just listened and he stepped into that very vulnerable, like, emotional space with me. Those next 3 days, those were really just the songs that were speaking to us at the moment. There were a few, or more than a few, that we were throwing around, but those were the ones that spoke to Nate also. You know, some of them, like, weren't even going to be on there. Like the piano songs, Popsicle and Dream Car. We had one day left. We were exhausted. We'd been in the studio for 2 days straight, had like brought a bunch of different musicians in, and we were just like in a sort of a fever dream at that point. And we were like, okay, we have like maybe 5 hours left in us. Let's get these songs out. And it was in a chapel, or I guess it was the church, like above us that we hadn't walked into yet. And so I went up there and Nate set everything up, and then he just like laid on the floor. He like pressed record and laid on the floor, and I would play the song and he'd say, again, and I'd play it and he'd say, one more time. And he just, and then eventually he'd be like, okay, that's the one. I learned so much from that experience. I learned how I work. Like, as a musician, I need someone to say, not that one, let's try it again. Or yes, that's the one. Because in here, like, none of it's good enough. The world will never hear it if it's just up to me. Yeah, I think a lot of it was just intuition and chance. And it really feels like an ode to our friendship in a lot of ways, because it was very much a combined effort, you know? He had such a hand in how that EP turned out.
Would now be a good time to play another song?
This song is, actually, it's kind of funny because when I wrote it, I was living in France and I had a student who was this very wild, like 50-year-old woman. who was always just saying things about fairies and how fairies lived in her backyard that she told me. So not the most reliable source for facts, but she told me that hummingbirds are insects. And for like a week, I was like, that's crazy. That changes the way I look at everything. And turns out they're not. but I decided to leave the line in there because it really, it kind of echoes just the way I was feeling at the time and what the song is about. Like I was looking at a relationship and realizing it was something other than what I thought it was when it was happening, and like questioning how much that actually mattered because I was past it now. And it's called The Bird and the Bug. This is the first song I ever wrote that I actually liked. So that was big.
in Dream Car, there's a line where you say there's just a really limited amount of storylines to choose from. And then after that, you say there are three things to say: thank you, I love you, I'm sorry. And so it's got me thinking about your wrestling with language and thinking about it in terms of belonging, thinking about it in terms of a barrier between people or a way to bridge between people. And I'm curious how much of writing the songs in this EP were a way for you to explore those challenges that we all face, but also maybe the possibilities that we're all yearning for, some kind of connection, some kind of love, some kind of being seen, some kind of a request for forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious about how much you were working with some of those themes in the lyrics.
You know, I think Dream Car is an outlier in that it was a conscious choice. I was like, these are, because I was thinking of a relationship that had ended and ended more than once. So it lasted a while, and I'd actually written that song years before for a show at Paige Turner's. I remember sitting down at my parents' piano, and Nate and I were playing that show, actually. And it was also about that relationship, which had ended the first time when I wrote it. And the lyrics were totally different. They were a lot funnier. They were a little more like nihilistic. I talked about like a spirit that like was let loose in his house at the time. So I reined it in. I actually finished the lyrics in the church right before we recorded the song. And we had just broken up, I think, for the second time. And yeah, I was just thinking like, if I can only say one thing to you, it's these three things. But also I want to say these things to every instance and every moment in my life. It's called Ho'oponopono. It's like a Hawaiian, it comes from some part of like a Hawaiian spiritual tradition that my friend was telling me about. I'm not doing it any justice because I don't really remember, but I just remember that the four like values are, I love you, thank you, I'm sorry, please forgive me, I think. And so that really tied into it too. It was like, if I can only find a few words, it's these. The storylines, not having enough storylines. I mean, that was just me. I'm like, oh, I can get married, or I can have one of these five acceptable jobs. And it's like, no one's telling me this stuff. This is just what I'm looking around and kind of seeing, a lot of repetition, I guess.
The song Popsicle, it is quite playful and it is quite jolly in many ways. And yet you do suggest this, as it were, a yearning for love that you want to linger throughout mm-hmm. life. And not to have love, as it were, flying over you like a bird. And the very last line, you vocally draw that out. And in some ways, it's not just singing. It comes across, or it came across to me, almost more like pleading. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how you try with your vocal performance to, you know, embody some of that emotional sentiment that is within the song.
Oh, absolutely. If anything, I try to rein it in, because like today I was practicing to perform at this interview, and I was crying while I was playing Avercom Skaters. And I was like, is this okay to do on stage? Like, because if I was being the most honest with myself, I would cry every time I played all of my songs, I think, because it is a yearning for connection. And it's one of the few places where I feel like I get to be totally outward with it. And so heard in that moment. So yeah, I'm definitely, I try to really create like a vulnerable space, I guess, with the audience, or a space that feels honest, just by bringing myself to the moment in a way that I can't in any other avenue. But sometimes I'm like, do I do it too much? I don't know.
You know, your songs have an attraction to them because there is something recognizable either in the joy and the play, but also in the lived experiences that I think as humans we all share. And in Minefield in particular, the last line is, love made my body a church of shame and I've forgotten how to pray, which obviously supposes that a prayerful life was something that was a part of your life. So before we talk about your spiritual life now, you've written, for example, about the experience of going to Christian camps and becoming alive to, you know, finding the love of God, but with other people. So it's pretty clear that spirituality and faith has been a part of your life. So what was spirituality like in your life?
Yeah, it's always been a part of my life. I guess I've always felt God's presence, even as I, from a very young age. I just remember like talking to God a lot all the time as a kid and enjoying prayer, like being in that space of openness, like trying to make contact with something greater. And I was raised Catholic. So, and we went to Mass every Sunday. I've only went to Catholic schools from truly like preschool to all the way through undergrad. And it wasn't until I was teaching that I stepped foot in a not Catholic school. And I just happened to live in two very Catholic cities. New Orleans is really Catholic. Omaha is a huge Catholic population. But I didn't like get into my faith until I was like, I think 17, like the summer right before I turned 18, some girls from school invited me to go to Steubenville Youth Conference. It's like a Catholic, I guess it's a camp. I don't know. We just like get in a big arena and sing songs and cry. And I've always been searching. I've always been very open to religion. When I went to that camp, I actually had like a conversion moment where I felt the presence of Jesus just like flood my body and like fill me with, like I felt whole in a way that I never felt whole. And I felt this like benevolent, loving presence that was so much greater than me. It started this very like religious moment in my life that lasted from when I was 18 to like 23. I was discerning like becoming a religious sister. I pretty much didn't date anyone those years because I was so focused on like spirituality and my relationship with God in a way that now I recognize as pretty unhealthy, honestly. I think I used religion to hide a lot. I was very religious for most of college. But just routinely, I kept bumping up against like my real life and the world where we all live collectively and like the world in my head. Eventually I had to step away because it was too, well, I couldn't be my full self, honestly, in Catholicism. I felt like there was only one version of myself that was acceptable. I couldn't find a way to love myself either. Like a lot of Catholic teachings just about sex and about it. So much of it is rooted in this sort of like platonic dualism, where there's like your mind and then there's your body. I realized like my last year of college, I was like, I can't move forward with my whole self in this space. So it was very intense for a while though. And I don't regret it because it showed me, I guess it like created a very deep space within myself for prayer. And that like continues today just in a different way.
You said that you feel like you, with your musical artistry and craft, are responding to a calling.
Mm-hmm.
Could you describe that a little more? Because to me that suggests that you are taking your creative talents and all of yourself and immersing it into this musical expression, but in a way that is responding to something that is outside of yourself, and it's something for you to live into.
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful question. I've never even considered it that way, but you're right. Like it is a response. I think it just exists in the same part of me. That same like inner space of prayer and of looking for God and learning about just what it means to be. It's just right in there with all of it. Like this need, and because it is a need. It's like more than a desire. It's like, if I'm not doing it, I'm sad. And I tried for so many years to do other things because it was more, you know, practical. I was like, okay, I'll be a teacher. I'll pursue all these other passions. But it's, yeah, I think there's just a part of me that wants to celebrate and wants to praise this, like the miracle of being alive, as cheesy as that sounds. And it feels so necessary. So I do feel like I'm responding, and in some ways, like my music is, you know, me working through like the experiences of my life, but also I want it to be reverent and sort of like the space I drop into inside when I'm working on a song is the same place that I drop into when I'm praying. Like I just try to find stillness, you know, and see what bubbles up and see what's been there all along. And that's how I felt when I had that conversion moment. I was like, oh my God, this love has always been here. I just need to like look towards it a little bit.
Would now be a good time to play another song?
This song is called Minefield from the Dream Car EP. And I wrote it when I was just very, very sad when I wrote it. That is why I say it's a sad song. It was after a breakup. And it was just how things looked and felt to me in the aftermath of that.
Thank you.
My guest today has been musician and writer Anna Schulte. Anna, thank you so much for sharing not only a little about your life, but also your musical talent with us.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
Lives is brought to you on KIOS Omaha Public Radio and is produced by Courtney Bierman. The music you hear playing in and playing out is performed by Andrew Bailey. Podcasts of today's show and others can be found at livesradioshow.com or where you get your podcasts. Subscribe today and please leave a review. I'm your host, Stuart Chittenden. Join me next week as we delve further into the practical and profound possibilities of living well. Thanks for listening.
Sorry, can I start over?